good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer with you on Morning Drive this morning on WTBR, Pittsfield Community Radio. I'm delighted that you're here spending the morning with us. I have a very interesting guest with us, no stranger to the Berkshires. Barbara Vinyar is with us, and the author of the upcoming, soon-to-be-released book, Little Bird. Barbara, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So tell me, this is your first book.
It is.
It must be incredibly exciting.
Every
to
time,
see it in print.
Every time I see my name on the cover of the book, I'm excited all over again, and not something I ever thought I would do, and I'm really happy.
We'll talk all about that process. How long did it take from the moment you had an idea until you held a book in your hand?
Completely from the moment I started writing, not planning to write a book, until now, 4 years.
That's a long time to live with these characters.
Well, they are literally family, some of them, and I love them.
Well, from what I understand of the plot, it's about a Jewish girl in the early 20th century in New York. Talk about the inspiration for the book first, where that comes
from. So the inspiration is actually my grandmother. And in 2021, a cousin sent me a picture of my grandparents. Very romantic picture. He's sitting on a park bench. She's kneeling with her head on his knee. Just beautiful picture. And I said to my cousin, I don't remember our grandparents being that affectionate. And she said, that's not our grandfather. And
oh.
I'm like, whoa, not something I ever knew, or certainly anything my grandmother told me. So shortly afterward, I hired a genealogist, and I found out that, in fact, my grandmother was married before the man who became my grandfather. And I found out a little bit. I found out where she was born in Russia. I found out the ship she sailed on, and she came with her father. I know the date they came. I know she got married. I know she got divorced. And that's it. That's all I know.
So where was she from?
She was from a town called Kamenets, Russia, in southwest Russia. I think it might be in Belarus now or Ukraine. It's a moving target.
Hard to tell. Yeah.
And she came to New York City and lived in Brooklyn.
So, but the book is not autobiographical. It's not a nonfiction. It's a fiction
Absolutely.
Book, right?
As I said, I had to make up pretty much everything. And I'm constantly having to remind myself as the author and my readers, this is not my family. It was an inspiration. It is not about them.
So did your family talk a lot about their family history, or was this kind of a new opening for you?
It was a brand new opening. I think that my grandparents on both sides were kind of closed about their histories. We knew they came from Russia. We knew there was violence in Russia that led them to leave. But once they were here, they talked about the future.
And have you gotten any feedback from the family yet?
The only people in my family who've actually read it are my children. And actually just one of my daughters, I gave her a copy early on. And she loved it. She loved the book. She said, Mom, I stayed up to find out what was happening. And she remembers my grandmother. But of course, a child, she was about 7 or 8, I think, when my grandmother died. She never thought of her as a woman with a history, a woman with a life.
Just
and honestly, in some ways, neither did I. She was my grandmother.
Yeah. And so how much of the detail, you say it's fiction, were there details from that genealogy that spoke to you that you were able to use? Or
well, I think the marriage, the fact that we think it was an arranged marriage, which is fairly common.
The first one?
Yes. An arranged marriage, and there was actually a newspaper article about her divorce. And in the newspaper article, her grounds for divorce were, I guess we would call it cruel and unusual punishment, and she said her husband never gave her any money for clothes, and she was applying for alimony. And at the end of the article, it said, the judge reserved his decision. So I never found out exactly what happened, but I have divorce paper, so I know she got divorced.
Yeah.
So that spoke to me, like, what was that marriage like? And she was 16 when she came here. So what was it like to come to a new country, have to learn English, have to learn new customs? She was traditionally raised, and her betrothed was an American. He came here when he was 2. So culture clashes, which are part of any immigrant story. I think even today, immigrants leave places because of threats, because of violence, and they're looking for a better life.
So how did you get to the fine detail? How much of the book takes place in Russia and on the passage over? And how did you do the research to give it that ring of authenticity?
I read other books, fiction and nonfiction, and went online. You know, a lot of this was during COVID when I was writing, and I went online constantly looking for information. I watched streaming from the Tenement Museum and other organizations. I listened to other authors on Jewish Women's Archives talk about their research process. So there was so much I needed to do. And I think in a way I was lucky because there were so many streaming things happening in COVID that might not have happened otherwise. And there is a lot written about the tenements, about immigrant life in New York. So I had a lot of resources to call on. But it got to the point where I printed out a calendar of every year that is in the book from 1910 to 1917. And at one point, I remember writing something like, it was a beautiful fall day. And I thought, I'd better look it up.
Is it really a beautiful
fall
day?
And you can go back and look at the weather. And I discovered in the writing of this book that there was a terrible heat wave in 1911. Hundreds, if not thousands of people died in New York City, in Connecticut, in New England. It was in the hundreds. And of course, they didn't have air conditioning. Very few people even had electric fans. And that was through the research process to make sure that I was being accurate if I said it was hot or I said it was cold. And so, you know, one thing led to another. And I loved that part of it. It was so interesting. I researched dresses, wedding dresses. There are two weddings, actually, in this book. And I sketched out what I thought her wedding dress might look like. So every little detail.
So you'd have that visual.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, without spoiling it for us, give us a little more of the plot?
It's about
a young woman who comes to the United States for an arranged marriage.
And she moves in with his family, her mother-in-law-to-be, and eventual mother-in-law is a wonderful, warm woman who takes her under her wing. She, one of her skills is embroidery. And she learned that in the old country, but she starts to do it in Brooklyn for some of their wealthy friends and her soon-to-be family. So that's big in the book, that the embroidery becomes something that she can earn a living at. She ends up getting divorced. He's not happy in the marriage. She's certainly not happy in the marriage. And she finally gets the courage to leave him. And divorce is actually more common than you might expect in the early 20th century among immigrants.
I was going to ask about that because it rated a newspaper article from what you said.
Right. Well, that's because she married into a wealthy family, too. I don't think that anyone's divorce would have been in the paper. But through my research, I found out that it wasn't as uncommon as you might think. But still, for a woman, a challenge. But by the time she got divorced, the rest of the family had come over. So she was able to move in with her father and mother and her younger siblings. She has an affair, and I don't want to say too much about that and give that away, but it's very fulfilling to her. It doesn't work in the end. And she's pretty much decided she's going to go it alone. You know, she has this skill. She gets a good job. She likes not answering to anyone. And then she meets another man. And he's very different and very respectful, but he's also more religious than she is. And she sort of strings him along for a while. And there is a happy ending.
But that's very unusual for women of that period to say, I'd rather be by myself.
I think it was. I think in some ways it still is. We have more permission, at least this week, to go it alone and to have fulfilling careers and financially fulfilling, which is people have to live. So, yes, I think it was, but she was very courageous and determined to do that, even though everyone told her, A, she was getting old because she was 23.
Oh, my goodness.
And that they, her mother and her sister-in-law and other people said to her, you don't have to be alone. You don't have to be alone. You can have respect and love and a future and children. She desperately wanted children.
Mm. So let's talk about the writing process particularly. Okay. Are you blah, blah, all out there on the page and then say, what have I done and go back? Or you sound like you're an outliner.
It's a little bit of both. I did start with an outline. The finished product more or less resembles the outline, but then things happened that I didn't anticipate. The affair that she has, I never knew that was going to happen. And in fact, there's a character in the book that I had not planned on, and she's on the boat here, you know, coming here. She goes up on deck to look for her father, and next to her is this young man that I didn't know existed, and he says hello. So there were things that happened as I was writing, and I was perfectly willing to just say, oh, I'll go with it.
Some writers talk a little bit of both. Some writers talk about the process that their characters tell them what they want to do next. Did you experience that?
Absolutely. And I remember when some of my writer friends told me that, I was like, ooh, you know. And I remember one writer friend said, my character spoke to me in the shower, and she said I was going in the wrong direction. And I thought that was a little bit weird. And then I had, not in the shower, but the same experience of a character who I planned to be one way, and that character just emerged in a totally different way, and it was that character's voice, and I needed to listen to that voice.
Yeah, it's pretty mysterious process, is it not?
It certainly is, but I loved it. I love the writing. I love sitting down and just losing myself in the characters and the details and the mundane things like the weather. I would lose all track of time. I didn't have a schedule. I know there are writers who get up in the morning and write every morning for 3 hours. I wrote when I wanted to, when I felt compelled to. But once I started writing, I didn't even know what time it was.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So you didn't necessarily write every day or write for the same amount of time?
Nope. I was just finding myself as a writer, and I had another life here in the Berkshires, you know, that I moved back here so that I could take advantage of everything. And so I started to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that today. I'm writing. And I needed to let people know that that was my job, that it was as important to me as anything they were doing. And that's the way I feel about it now. And now I'm into marketing, mm-hmm. but I sit down at my computer every single day and I think about what is it that I need to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed in your bio that you are very well traveled. Can you talk about how the travels affected your worldview as you looked at this book, as you set characters in a sense of place?
Well, I think for one thing, I've been to many places where there were camps for immigrants, and I've seen what that experience can be. It was not my family's experience. Nobody ended up in a camp. But I understood that desperation, that need to get away from a place. I did have a chance to go to Russia, but that was before I knew where this grandmother came from, but I knew where the other side of the family came from. And I remember I went to an Orthodox church for Easter, and the Cossacks were part of the ceremony. They marched out with the priests. And I remember talking to the person who was showing me around and saying, well, if it weren't for the Cossacks, I might still be here. You know, I might have grown up here. But the violence was something that my family had to get away with, and in particular, the men. Well, the women were in danger of violence and rape, the men were in danger of having to go into the army, and then they disappeared. They could be gone for years and years, yeah. and they were literally cannon fodder. You know, if there was something dangerous, let's put the Jewish boys in the front. There was a real compelling need for them to get away.
Yeah, yeah. Now, before you got into this book 4 years ago, you were a pretty prolific blog poster.
I was.
You still do that?
Not so much. I've started Substack, which is in a way like a blog post.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
And when I started blogging, it was mostly because I was a leadership coach. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get out there with blogs about leadership. And then I thought, well, that's kind of boring, actually. And I would write about the hummingbirds on my front porch or anything that I just felt like talking about. And very often there were social issues and political issues and family events. So I love the writing, and I still do. Yeah. And I am actually working on another book. But in the meantime, I do these Substacks every 2 weeks, which are kind of essays, and I enjoy that too.
How do you approach that process? Is it different? Do you do a lot of revision, or do you just put it out there?
Much less on the blogs and the Substack.
Yeah.
I mean, I want it to be literate, but it's not perfect, and I don't work with anybody else like I did on the novel.
Yeah. Now, how do you find your audience and understand audience reaction and like blog posts? Because it goes out to, you know, in a book, it's got to be somebody who reads and either buys it physically or buys it online. So you know there's something about a person who reads. Blog posts are people who are online.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you envision your audience, or do you care?
I think I don't care. With Substack, most of my Substacks are about the writing process. I just did one called A Room of My Own, which is all about my office, and it had more pictures, actually, than words. So for the Substack, I am looking for people who are readers, other writers that I can be in community with. But with the blog, I just put it out there.
Yeah.
That was fine.
And you did a COVID memoir, too.
I did. And actually, a lot of this writing started with a class I took through OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at BCC, called Writing Your COVID Memoir. And it kind of got me in the discipline of writing, working with other writers as we critique each other's work. We're still a group. I mean, I am still in touch with all of those writers, and one of them was a beta reader for the book, and in fact, we're all going to the theater on Saturday, I still think of them as my writing community, and the COVID memoir was a very powerful experience, only a couple of pages, but it was a very powerful experience because it made me think about what was happening to me. I was afraid of dying. You know, this was,
I think we all were.
This was the beginning of COVID. There was no vaccine yet. And I did it thinking about my mother and her calendar and how she had dementia and as how when that progressed, her calendar got empty. And I thought, that's what happened to me in COVID.
Overnight.
You know, I kept crossing things out and canceling things. So it was a very powerful experience.
So you've learned a lot about yourself through this writing process. Can you talk a little bit about that process and what you've gone through? You go through something to get it on the page, but you go through something above the neck, too, I think, when you write.
I have often said that as I was writing, quote, my grandmother's story, unquote, I'm really writing my story. You know, I'm writing the story of somebody who finds courage, who decides that she can go it alone, who then finds somebody else in her life. And that's not all true of my personal story. But I think that whole part about finding oneself is very much my story. And as I was writing it, I knew that. I knew this is as much Barbara as it is Fanny.
Mm-hmm. Many have said that, you know, the character arc is the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the hero's journey for your little bird? What's the...
Well, the hero's journey is, it's about courage. It doesn't, you know, I remember reading a long time ago that the male hero's journey is always outward. Go out and conquer. The female hero's journey is more interior and more in a house, in rooms in a house. And I think that's very true of a woman in early 20th century America. That's who she was. And she loved that part of it. I can't say that about myself. Mm-hmm. But she loved that part of it. She loved cooking, sewing. She wanted to take care of a family. So I think that was her journey. But to do it in a way that said, this is who I am. You can't make me do it. I have to want to do it.
And right now, having any kind of Jewish identity is very fraught because mm-hmm. of events in the world. At the beginning of your book, this was not such an issue. How's that affected you?
Well, as a writer and now a published author, I'm afraid. I have to say, when I was interviewing the publisher at Sibylline Press, one of the things they said that made me feel confident about choosing them was that they support their Jewish authors, because Jewish authors are being boycotted. It started with a boycott of Israeli authors, but people don't distinguish between Israeli, Jewish, Zionist, non-Zionist. And I want this book to stand on its own. It shouldn't matter that there's an ethnic identity or a religious identity, but that's who I am, and I'm proud of that. But there's an element of, will people turn against me and the book simply because I'm Jewish?
Yeah, yeah. You said that you're working directly on marketing the book now. Mm-hmm. How do you take that flavor into account to kind of counteract that as you put the book out there?
You know what? I'm just putting it out there and proudly claiming that this is a Jewish story. When I put all my hashtags on my Instagram posts, I put Jewish fiction. It is. And I certainly don't want to get review bombed, but I'm not hiding this. This is who I am, and this is who the story is about.
Now, you said you're working on an outline for the next book. Are you staying in the same genre? Are you moving completely differently?
No, it will still be historical fiction. It actually will pick up where this book ends. And there is also a family inspiration. So I have a lot of research to do because this book will go through World War II, and some of the experiences in that war will be critical to the book. And it feels different because it's going to be about a man. And yes, we think alike and feel alike, but we also think differently and feel differently. Yeah. And I feel like that's a real challenge.
So what's the tug about historical fiction that attracts you?
I don't know what I would have said before writing this. I think I was like reading historical fiction. I like learning about other eras and putting myself in different places, different time periods. Yesterday, I had a chance to hear Jane Phillips, the Pulitzer Prize winner who wrote Night Watch, and she added so much to my reading of the book, but I probably wouldn't know very much about the Civil War, and I just have always enjoyed that genre.
Now, through that process, you had many readers and many revisions. Mm-hmm. Can you share some of the revelations that some of your early readers gave you about the book and what they thought it meant that you had no idea where that would have come from?
I don't know the meaning. I work with three different developmental editors. Well, two developmental editors and one teacher at a writing residency, which was an incredibly valuable experience. And they were really helpful in pointing out at the beginning a kind of lack of content, conflict. I was kind of just writing the story. And the other thing I learned from them that appeared to be missing was the visual. In other words, one of them would say to me, you're creating a movie. Since people can't see it, you have to help them see it. So, and that led, again, as I said, to the research. Okay, what was she wearing? What did it look like? What did it feel like? What is it like to step into an elevator when you never even imagined such a thing existed? So the readers were helpful in saying, I need to see it. I remember one reader said, I got lost in the time frame. So each part of the book now says 1910 to 1912, so you get a better sense of how time is passing. And there's also a lot of events in here that ground the book, the sinking of the Titanic, the world championship boxing when a Negro, which is what they would have said at the time, won for the first time, and there were riots. So I put in a lot of things that were happening, the heat wave, World War One. World War One is very powerful in this book.
Yeah. Some have said about the writing process, too, that to be successful at it, you have to be ruthless. You have to kill your little darlings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have an issue with your editors where you just, a lavender paragraph just had to stay, though everyone said it really has to go, Barbara?
I don't know that anybody ever said it really has to go. They might have said, you have to fix it. And then I cut 20,000 words before this book was published.
It's almost a book.
it's considerable amount, and it was really because editors and one publisher said, too long. And I thought, well, let me cut it rather than somebody else cut it. One thing I think I did keep in that one publisher had said needed to be shorter, the time frame from leaving Russia to arriving in the U.S., the scenes on the train, the scenes on the ship, they wanted that to be shorter. And I felt it was really important because one of the themes of this book is I will be brave. And that's what she tells her mother before she leaves, and that journey is the beginning of her seeing what it takes to be brave.
Yeah,
not getting
there
quite yet, but learning about it.
So did it stay in?
It did.
It did?
I did. I made cuts, but that journey definitely is still there.
Yeah. So when a publisher is saying to you, it's too long, what does that mean?
By the way, I did not publish with that publisher. What it means is make those cuts. If you want to be considered by us, it can't be more than 100,000 words.
So it's the publisher's sense of how much people will read?
I think that's a big part of it. And this book, I believe, is 300 total. Let's see, 386 pages, which is long.
And how many words does that translate to?
I'm pretty sure it was about 100,000 words, but this also has the acknowledgments and the author's note, so some of that is added in there. But it was about 100,000. I had 130,000 and 120, and I cut it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's better. I think I made a lot of it much sharper. And it's interesting. So my beta readers read it, and a beta reader is a first reader, who give you early feedback. So they're reading it again, and nobody has said to me, oh, I wish you hadn't cut whatever, because I cut details that weren't necessary. It's a rigorous process. It's a painful process, you said, those little darlings. Those are my words.
You have to kill your darlings, And, gee, they were so wonderful together.
But
do you ever save things? Do you tape stuff up and save it for another day?
Well, I have drafts. I have every draft. I have paper copies in the closet. I have, up in the cloud, on my desktop. And what I did to keep track of everything, I remember watching an author on some streaming interview, and she had on her wall, the index cards. Like the whole wall was just covered, and that's how she plotted it out and kept track of things. And I have paintings and things all over the walls in my office, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then a friend said, oh, I watched something the other day, and she had a whiteboard. So I got myself a whiteboard, and right now you can see the original section, which are mostly quotes about writing, because I was still new to that practice. So there were quotes about conflict and quotes about character development. And then I moved into the research, and that's where you're going to see the calendars. And I created a family tree that went back generations before this book started. So that's up there. And now as I've moved into marketing, there's a whole other calendar of you know, what needs to happen when.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's how I put it all up there. And you can see the things that I'm sure I'm going to use in the next book.
Yeah. Well, hold that thought, because we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to talk some more about Barbara Vinayar's first book, Little Bird, which is going to hit the shelves in mid-August. So stay with us.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM. You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Wonder what happened to those great local PCTV channels? Did you lose them? No worries, they're still there. Go to cable channels 1301, 1302, and 1303 to watch the best local content on television. News and information, sports and entertainment, city council, school committee, July 4th parade. It's all there waiting for you. Pittsfield Community Television. For over 30 years, we are still your local television.
The Pittsfield Health Department is hosting monthly wellness clinics available to the community at the Christian Center, Senior Center, Epworth Arms, Capitol Square, and South Congregational Church. Vital sign checks, medication reviews, and health assessments are offered by the public health nurse. Our social worker will be there with information of available resources as well. For more information about these clinics, please contact us at 413-499-9411.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Welcome to Beyond, a one-hour program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. I'll be your host, Beverly Prentice. Listen in every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. My email is beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sandrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Ellen Speer. I'm here in the studio with Barbara Vinayar, who is anticipating the release of her first book, Little Bird, which will hit the shelves and the online ordering of the world about mid-August. We were talking about the plot of the book, but another interesting plot twist is that Barbara was the president of Berkshire Community College in her previous career before becoming a writer. How did you get into public education like that, particularly at the community college level?
I guess everything is a story, Ellen.
Yes.
So
yes.
I was getting my master's degree in English literature, and they had a program. This was at Lehman College in the Bronx in New York, and they had a program that placed people with community colleges.
Yes.
And then you would work with different teachers and sort of learn how to teach English. Mm-hmm. Well, I had already moved up here. I had moved to Rockland County, and
yes.
I said, well, I live right down the block from the community college. Can I work something out there? And they said yes, and I went to the community college, worked with lots of different English teachers about teaching English, and then they gave me a job in their writing center, which was really kind of a tutoring thing, and I just loved it. And I loved being in a community college. I loved the students who were all ages, all backgrounds. And you probably can see some of their stories in and the story that I wrote, you know, people who wanted a better life and saw the community college as a way to get it. Women who came because they had gotten divorced and needed to earn a living. So I think it was my love of students that really pushed me into a career. And then I got a full-time job at the college as a research assistant, which I thought was going to be boring. And it turns out it was a grant-funded program that was brand new. And I got to help shape it and recruit and evaluate. And I loved it. So I never looked back.
But there was a little writing in the background there, was there not?
And I always wrote. You have to in academia. I didn't become a teacher, so I knew that it wasn't going to be a publish or a perish that I needed for tenure. And I was always the storyteller. So what I say to people is when we were writing an article or a report, I would say to my colleagues, okay, you work with the data, I'll tell the stories. And you need both. If you want to convince a legislator to fund you, you need the numbers because they're going to say, well, how do I know that works? And then when you bring in the one student whose life was changed, they go, aha. So you really need both. And I was the get the student whose life has changed and tell their story.
Yeah. So how did it come about that you were tapped to lead the organization?
Well, at my first college, at Rockland Community College, I started out as a paraprofessional and ended up as a vice president, and then I applied for presidencies. I think I knew early on that that's something I wanted to do, and I had some very interesting role models. Of course, when I was coming up, it was not like it is now. There were fewer women, and there was an organization for women in community colleges that I became part of, and help make that part of my story, you know, mm-hmm. that I'm a very capable leader who happens to be a woman.
Yeah. The Berkshires has changed a great deal, mm-hmm. and the role of Berkshire Community College has changed a great deal. From your very specific and interesting vantage point, what do you see?
Well, I think what they've done is extraordinary, and I think that the free community college is changing lives. Back to my theme. I'm actually going over to the campus on August 16th for their 65th anniversary. And I think what they've done physically is amazing, that the renovations are extraordinary and bringing it into the 21st century, you know, that they've just done so much and their ability to serve students. I'm looking forward to seeing the library renovations. Because I remember when I was there, if you needed to use a wheelchair, you literally couldn't get into the library. You could get into one level, but then you had to go out, go to another building, take a freight elevator, go down. And basically, we were told, well, if you want to fix that, you're going to have to renovate the whole thing. And they've just done so much since I was there that I think is just extraordinary.
Now, community colleges are thought of or used to be thought of differently than colleges and universities. Why was that? And how did you deal with that perception that somehow it wasn't like a real college, even though we know it is?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that's gone away. I think there are still people who say, I'm only going to a community college. And community colleges can be what we call terminal degrees that enable people to go directly into the workplace, or they are absolutely the equivalent of the first 2 years of college. And many students use that to their advantage. It's less costly. It's closer to home. They get their first 2 years under their belt, and then they go on. And in fact, sometimes the faculty are the same faculty. Community college faculty teach part-time at some of the other state colleges and universities. So they're directly equivalent. And it just takes a lot to let the world know. And you asked me before about my world travels and my view. Because of that, it's even harder when you go abroad, where many countries have the system that weeds people out, and only the very elite go to universities, and they don't understand community colleges. They have technical schools that are strictly technical, but they don't have any place that eases that transition into college.
Yeah, so, you don't read a book and then learn how to do car stuff. You're in the car stuff.
Yeah. I think the other thing that has sort of changed in community and college is how expensive it is to offer those programs. You can't run a nursing program now without state-of-the-art mannequins when I was at Chesapeake, we opened a new health center and we had a mannequin that gave birth and you could program to have an easy birth, a breech birth. And someone said to me, and does she curse the father? And I said, yes, in seven languages. And all of that equipment is so expensive. If you want to teach automotive technology, you need the latest cars.
Yeah.
And I remember walking into a lab once at my first college, and I said, all these cars are much nicer than mine. And they said, yes, because people need to learn on the latest technology. Yeah. So it's so expensive. And people used to ask when I was here and my other colleges, well, why don't you teach people plumbing and electrical technician? And I was like, well, because a lot of that is expensive and those are long apprenticeship kinds of programs. And then I would ask some of the people who were urging me to do that, where do your kids go to school? Mm-hmm. And they're all in pre-med and pre-law. And I said, yeah, and maybe they'll make as much money as the electrician who just came to my
house.
Perhaps,
yeah.
But there's that social conflict in our culture about who's valued and who isn't.
Yeah. So what did you find as your biggest community, not necessarily challenge is too strong a word, but what was the perception that you needed to overcome? Was it all about money and going to Beacon Hill? Was it all about talking to the community and integrating your work? Where did you spend the most time?
That's a good question, because I think fundraising was
always
probably the biggest part of my job, and that was new to my generation of college presidents who relied on public funding. And public funding just got to be a smaller and smaller and smaller piece of the community college budget. And so you had to turn to private donors. You had to turn a lot to grants writing. Mm-hmm. And so then your budget spent more money on development. And people, well, what do you need all these administrators? And that and regulation. I mean, I certainly remember the HR in particular regulations that come from federal and state and local. And that staff had to expand because nothing was on a handshake anymore. Everything was contractual. And Massachusetts is a union state. So there's union negotiations, union contracts. There's so much to think about. In Maryland, it's not a union state. And yet I was constantly involved in personnel actions. And there's so much law that exists now to protect employees. And, well, I don't know going into the future how much there will be. But so the regulatory environment increased tremendously, and that takes people, takes staff. And as I said, then people go, well, why are you spending all that money on administrators? Well, they're not administrators in the sense of management. They're administrators in the sense of they're not teaching.
Yeah.
They're just running the place.
Yeah. Is there a golden ratio for that? Like, is it two behind the scenes to one in front of students?
If there is, I don't know it. I just know it's probably out of balance.
And
what we need are people in front of students. But in front of doesn't only mean teaching.
Yeah.
It means counseling. It means coaching. I mean, there's a lot of other ways that people are in front of students.
Yeah. Now, while you were doing that job, which is a big job, it's not 24/7, it's probably 28/7. were you writing all that time?
No. I wrote poetry. I took a lot of poetry classes. Well, not a lot of, but occasionally. And as I said, I wrote articles.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote articles for academic journals or academic newspapers. Mm-hmm. I did some op-ed, local op-ed writing, but I never dreamed of writing fiction. People say, well, didn't you always want to write a novel? No, it never even occurred to me.
Can you talk about the poetry that's such a different way of writing, that's so spare, and boy, talk about Kill Your Little Darlings.
There's I don't know, but it always just appealed to me.
Yeah.
And then actually when I moved back here in 2018, I was writing a haiku every day. another accident in my life. A friend of mine said, oh, and I write a haiku every morning. And I said, well, that's probably good discipline. You know, it just gets your mind going in a certain way. And a haiku is very structured, five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables. And I liked it. I like the discipline of that. I like trying to say something in a very specific way.
And it's very spare for those mm-hmm. who don't know. It's three lines that mm-hmm. you described, and it's just a swoosh at a moment, is it not?
It is. And as I said, I liked, it was a practice. Some people meditate. Some people do certain kinds of exercises. I wrote a haiku.
Yeah.
And I actually just stopped that a little while ago. Mm-hmm. Mostly because I was learning all these new marketing things. I will go back to it because I really liked it.
Would you ever do anything with the poems that you wrote before as well as the haiku? Well, do you think organize them in some way to get them out there?
I wasn't really good about keeping that. I'd have to go through some really old things to find the older poems. But the haikus I have. I have every one I've ever written. Many of them are on my website. And as I said, I'll go back to that. I had the chance to take a trip to the Azores in April. It was a women's retreat, a wellness retreat, and it was wonderful. And I wrote every day there. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I knew I had a publisher for the novel. So I sort of in between, okay, I finished writing the novel, and I'm not marketing yet. And I was in a new place with surrounded by so many beautiful things. So I wrote every morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, talk about going forward, the next book or books. It sounds like you have made a career transition, and this is what you're going to do now. Do you work on more? Do you have more ideas than the one you're working on that you're making notes for?
I had another idea that may not work out because that would require research in another country. And it's about somebody who has a living grandchild. And I'm not sure how to fictionalize that when there's still family. I mean, my grandmother, I have lots of cousins. We have family around. But she's not recognizable in this book. And I'm not worried about it. But to take a public figure and write a historical novel, I'm not sure how that works. I'm taking notes.
Yeah, so. Someone who's living.
Public figure isn't living, but the grandchild is. I think I have to feel passionate about it. And right now I'm very focused on where I'm going, where this book ended and the next one begins. It's the same family, but very, very different.
Yeah. Can you see taking a third step from where this next one ends, or you don't know when the next one's going to end yet?
I don't know. I have to say that the publisher of my book, Sibylline Press, specializes in works by women over 50. And there comes a point where I wonder, how old can I be when I'm still writing? So the next one for sure, and then we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. So it's still a daily practice for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working on the next one. Are you going to be thinking about sales figures or looking at that once the book's released? Does your publisher, have they given you some sort of guidelines on what they're going to be looking for?
Well, my publisher said when I signed the contract, we're in business to sell books.
Uh-huh.
But I'm so new to this, Ellen. I really can't tell you. Someone recently said, well, what do you want out of this? And I said, well, clearly I want to sell books. But I think I want to be a writer. So working on the next book makes me feel like that's accomplishing that. I love talking to people. I love talking to you. I will go to book clubs. I will go to communities. I usually go to Florida for a month in the winter, and then there's so many communities down there that have clubs, and I'll speak there. I am doing a reading at Barnes & Noble. I'm doing one at my temple. I like engaging with people, and of course, once the book is out there, I don't know what's happening, but when I get to talk to people, I get that immediacy, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Are you going to be doing book tours, formal book tours, do you think?
No. I mean, I'm going to be doing readings. Book tours are usually for very well-known authors and major publishers. And The other thing is I live in the Berkshires, you know, so I look at some of the other authors that this publisher works with, and, you know, they live in Boston or they live in New York, and their book tours could be in their borough, and yeah. there'll be six bookstores.
Zillions of people, yeah.
Right, and we just don't have that. And again, you know, going back to COVID turned out to be a good thing for my writing, mm-hmm. we have Zoom. And I'm very happy to talk to people. I have family and friends. I probably will do a California sweep because I have friends from family from San Francisco to San Diego.
Yeah.
And I've already said to them, you know, get me in front of your book clubs and I'll be there. So I'll do that.
Yeah. And New York is not so far away, is it really?
No, actually, I will be at the Brooklyn Book Festival in September. And I will be at the Boston Book Festival in October.
And so, now how do those work?
My publisher takes a table and I go and sign books.
Uh-huh.
And in both cases, I know a lot of people in those areas and I will say, okay, come at 11 o'clock and I'll be there and mm-hmm. I'll sign your book.
Yeah. So who do you read?
Who do I read? Oh, God, I read everybody. Right now I'm reading a lot of the authors from my publisher and one, her name is Suzanne Samuels, and her book is called Seeds of the Pomegranate. And you could put our books side by side and say, oh, did you work together? Her book is about an Italian immigrant who comes here fairly young. She's been trained as an artist, which is unusual for a girl of her time, not knowing that what her family has in mind is that she'll be a counterfeiter. And it's about her finding the courage to get away from that environment and the family. So I enjoy, again, it's a historical novel. I'm reading Night Watch by Jane Phillips. I love Anita Diamond's fiction. And she was here recently, was very helpful in talking to me.
Do you have guilty pleasure books that you read?
For me, everything's a pleasure. I don't know if it's a guilty pleasure. I'm not a big nonfiction reader.
I'm thinking of, like, beach books.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Oh, but I will tell you. So yesterday, I think the New York Times had an article about cozy mysteries. And the person who was writing said, oh, I always used to look down on cozy mysteries. And you know what? I immediately went and downloaded some because I thought, I need to get away sometimes. I'm not mm-hmm. at the beach, mm-hmm. but I need a book that's just funny and cute and everything gets solved in the end and there's no violence, which is why it's called the cozy mystery.
I see.
And so those would be my guilty pleasures. I love mysteries. I do read a lot of mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes they're just too gory. I'm not interested in the thriller that's filled with blood and guts.
Yeah.
So, but I wouldn't read cozy mysteries regularly,
mm-hmm.
but I was like, oh, yes. You know?
Who is your favorite historical fiction author?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I'm trying to think.
You won't
who
make
I love.
Everybody angry, I don't think.
You know, it's funny because yesterday Jane Phillips had a list of four authors that she thought every writer should read, and they were men. And at the Q&A, someone said, well, who are the women? And she mentioned Catherine Porter and some women from the past. And then someone reminded her about Edith Wharton. She said, I can't mention any current authors because I'm sure I'll omit somebody. Anita Diamond, for example, is a historical.
Sure.
Geraldine Brooks, anything she writes. Alice Hoffman, some of her books would be historical mm-hmm. fiction. Mm-hmm. So those mm-hmm. are three that come right to mind.
And you have the wish I wrote that syndrome when you read those?
Someone asked me the other day, one of the writers from my writing group, he said, do you have writer's remorse? I said, every time I pick up the book, I go, oh, there should have been a comma there. I should have left that out. I should, why didn't I tell them about this? So maybe that's why I need to write another book.
Yeah. Is there an opportunity after something's published in a second printing to be able to go back in and tweak?
You can correct errors, but you really, you know, that's a whole new run, and I don't know of any publisher that wants to do that.
So after it's out there, it's history,
out there.
And
that's
it.
Exactly.
So you're hoping for this to be merchandised how at local bookstores? You want to see it up front for
everybody? It will be available. It's already available for pre-order at Barnes & Noble.
Uh-huh.
It will be at the bookstore in Lenox, probably in the fall, mm-hmm. Not right away. And right now it's available, as I said, Barnes & Noble online, pre-order, bookshop.org, which is also a way to give to your local bookshop that I love doing.
Yeah.
Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, Amazon, of course. Amazon, you can only pre-order the ebook. The print will be available on publication date.
Yeah.
And then through the publisher, through Sibling Press.
Yeah. Final-ish question, though we have some time for it. How did you get to the title Little Bird?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So the heroine's name in Yiddish, her given name in Russia, was Fega. And the diminutive of Fega is Fegala. And Fegala means little bird. And interestingly, I was working with a developmental editor, Sonia Pilster. Some people may recognize her. She wrote The Holocaust Kid and The Last Hotel. And she wanted me to call the book Broken Candlesticks. Candlesticks figure prominently in the book. And I actually do have my grandmother's candlesticks, one of which is broken. And so in the book, they break in a particularly dramatic way. I have no idea how they broke. And I said, no, it's Little Bird. I just knew from almost the beginning that this was going to be called Little mm-hmm. Bird.
Do you have a working title for your next book yet?
No, I don't. And I've been thinking about that. I did learn one thing, though. When I started writing this book, I looked on Amazon to see, like, are there other Little Birds? And I didn't see a lot. Well, then, when the book went up on pre-order, not only are there other little birds, but one of them is a children's book, and it was the author of that book was listed as a co-author of my book. It was just a big snafu.
Ooh.
It got corrected, but there are a lot of little birds.
Yeah.
So people have to search for Little Bird by Barbara Vinier.
Well, I wish you every success
with that
book. My guest this morning has been Barbara Vinier, the author of Little Bird, which is coming out in this mid-August, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have a local author in our midst.
Thank you.
And we wish you every success with it. Thank you very much. My name's Ellen Speer. Thanks so much for being with us this morning on Morning Drive. You're listening to WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Have a wonderful day.